right? You were at Dumbarton Oaks, you were at Yalta and at San Francisco. How has the charter, which you helped to draft, stood the test of time? Is it indeed a revision?
Well, I don't think you can revise it, because under the charter itself it can only be revised as a consent effectively of the Russians. You would have to have American and Soviet agreement on any revision. If you got that, you probably would be able to.
Yes.
So it would still be subject in principle to a veto of China.
But my question is it in need of revision?
Oh, well,
or not?
I think really if you could get any kind of American Soviet cooperation, it would make the present charter work perfectly well, in my view. I don't see why you didn't necessarily revise it, I don't think. I still thought you might possibly get the question of voting in the assembly rather regulated. It seems rather absurd now when you get states of minute of 100,000, 20,000 people having one vote, and China 100 million, a billion people having one vote too. In principle, it seems to me to be rather wrong. But I dare say it's the only way to make it work at all.
I was going to say it's an extremely sensitive issue.
Well, I suppose.
On the part of the many states, yes.
I suppose, but even so, it seems rather ridiculous, really.
What do you think about the attitude?
I once thought it would be a good thing to have a resolution. If we're going to give the resolutions the assemblies rather more power and give them any more effective, make them more effective, you might have a system whereby it would have to be a two-thirds resolution embodying two-thirds of the population of the world. In which case, there'd have to be, out of 4 billion people or more, there'd have to be 3 billion people effectively represented here who'd have to vote for it.
Well, we got China and India and Pakistan and Indonesia.
Well, India and China, they would only be two. We wouldn't have two-thirds of them. We'd have to have America and Europe and Russia, or one of them, come in too.
Yes, that's true. What about the attitude of member states like Gladwin toward the UN? They seem to have lost a lot of the enthusiasm, the member states, that they had 40 years ago.
I don't think that the average person knows much or cares much about the United Nations nowadays. There's very little enthusiasm for it. But I don't think it matters very much. It's governments that matter. If we can get the governments to be reasonable, then it doesn't matter much what people think, as populists think. It just come about, and automatically think it's a good thing. If you can get agreements between the great powers, notably the Soviet Union and the Americans, everybody will be too happy. And then, of course, the stock of this organization goes straight up. You can't increase the stock of this organization by organizing propaganda and saying, because it's a very good show, you must all come and have meetings and say it's marvelous, you see. And it doesn't do much good.
Now, do you think this commemorative session of the last 10 days or so, with all these heads of state and government, was this a ritual, or do you think that they really felt that this place is still important?
Yes, I think so. You know, it's still as important as simply as a meeting ground. It is important, I think, isn't it? And if there's ever going to be any kind of a lackening of tensions between the superpowers, it quite likely happened here in the corridors. People would meet each other in minor ways, and certainly the situation would be worse off if it didn't exist. There's no doubt about that. And I think there's an article in the New York Times just the other day said precisely that, and I agreed with it. But I think everything depends really on the governments being reasonable. Of course, sometimes it's arguable that the whole human race has gone mad. Of course, it's quite possible to think that. But on the assumption that it hasn't gone mad, you must go on the assumption, of course, that the human race has not gone mad. What the Germans call the Als-Ob theory. And that's the only thing you can do, because if they've all gone mad, there's nothing to be done. They should all be blown up. But seeing that it's absolute, if reason has anything to do with it at all, it must mean the nuclear war is out. Of course, people don't really want, not even governments don't really want to be blown up, and therefore it probably won't happen.
No, they wouldn't have anybody to govern.
Well, it would all be in smoke. There'd be a nuclear winter, and that'd be the end.
Do you find that the fact that the UN has increased from, say, 1951 at the time of the signing of the from 51 at the time of the signing of the charter, to 159 today. Is
51?
51 in San Francisco. There are 51 member states.
Oh, then, yes, I see. Well, of course, it's made it much more kind of difficult to govern. I myself think it was not a mistake to admit everybody. There ought to have been a numerical limit on below which they shouldn't really be governed by people, I think, myself. That's what I feel myself. Otherwise, I don't have San Marino or Monaco or Andorra or anywhere.
Yeah.
On this equal level with China. It does seem a little odd, really. I think there ought to have been a numerical limit, perhaps a million people or something like that, myself.
Or class of associate membership or something?
Well, they could have all got together and have an associate membership, something like that, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's too late. What about the Security Council?
Indeed, the Europeans, of course, ought to have one member, really, if it comes to that. The EEC ought to have one member. That would have been reform the Security Council itself, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. I can see Britain and France competing for the same.
Well, we could toss up or something.
Yeah. Now, you sat on the Security Council for a long time.
Yes.
How do you think it is effective?
Well, in my day, it was quite effective, really, yes. But we did some sensible decisions. Of course, in my day, it was quite different. Even up to the time I left at the end of 54, beginning of 54, we had Commonwealth meetings. We had Commonwealth policy. Even the Indian came along. We formed a Commonwealth policy, which was then adopted by me in the Security Council and all that. Mm-hmm. But things have changed very substantially since then.
But you do now have common market consultations, don't you?
Yes, we have common market consultations, quite true.
Yes, that is it.
That didn't happen in my day.
Yeah.
That wasn't formed.
Now, your first employee and your protege, Brian Urquhart, I guess maybe it's your second employee, is now in charge of the UN peacekeeping.
Oh, yes, well, that is.
And peacekeeping is not a device provided for in the Charter.
No, it came out. Well, it came out of the sort of military staff committee idea, in a way. Yes.
But some people consider it one of the most important UN contributions.
I think we can exaggerate that, but I think it's played a role, and indeed a beneficent role. There are about five in operation now, and they can't do very much, but they do hold the ring, certainly in Cyprus and even in Lebanon to some extent, and therefore it's obviously a good thing as such, yes. I think it exaggerates importance. If things got really tough, of course, I'd just say they'd all be killed or something, but they can't shoot anyhow. But it does do. Yes, I quite agree. It is a new initiative, which has a certain effect.
Yes. And then one final question, if I have the time, Lord Godwin. How do you consider the future of the United Nations? Do you think about it?
Well, I think unless I say the human race goes mad, it means that they'll get agreement on arms eventually. Then the thing will sober up, I think, and it'll be more use that the more power will generate in this particular machine. But it all depends, really, on whether you can get. In my view, I think everything depends on the two superpowers coming and getting agreement on arms agreement of some kind, and that would lead to some kind of lack of cooperation, if you like. Indeed, it's absurd not to think of it, because their interests in many ways are identical.
Now, you keep talking simply in the terms of the Soviet Union and the United States. Where does China fit into this?
Well, China hasn't really organized itself yet, but it will. I was there about 3 or 3 4 years. I'm a hero in China, you know, because when I was president of the Security Council, I think it was just started coming to the war. Anyhow, I managed, as president, to overrule the veto of Chiang Kai-shek, you see, the representative of Chiang Kai-shek, and overrule the double veto, so to speak, and got the Americans to abstain with great reluctance, and therefore addressed an invitation to the Red Chinese to come and represent it here. And General Wu came over with a delegation, and we had lunch with us and all that. He didn't do much good. They went back. We stayed with the Russians and went back. We're still there. It was the first time that they were at Mandarin was talking to the Security Council, and they were very grateful for that. So when I went to China about two or three years ago, I found that General Wu was the Vice Chief of General Staff in Peking. I was received with great acclaim as a sort of hero, as a sort of friend of Red China. Yeah. And indeed, after that, I lost my popularity here because the China lobby then attacked me like anything. And I was regarded as a villain more than a hero then.
I must add one story there for the record. I believe that Sir Benegal Rao.
Who?
Sir Benegal Rao was on the Security Council as the Indian representative.
Yes, he was, yes.
And I remember the remark of The Economist at the time. Mm-hmm. That General Wu did all the rowing, and Sir Benegal Rao did all the wooing.
They liked it. I've forgotten that.
Yes.
They liked it. Sir Benegal Rao was a blameless character, very nice. General Wu was rather tough, but a good chap.
Yes. What do you have any final thoughts you want to give us before we terminate this interview?
No, I think one must go on and peg away, and I think it's just not necessary to be completely gloomy, unless, as I say, you have the impression that the human race has gone mad. I remember that, this might end the interview, when we were in San Francisco, the The Russians had a legal advisor called Galunsky, and he was very gloomy, and he died of consumption shortly afterwards, but he was very gloomy, very nice, and we fraternized. He used to come dine with us, you see. And we found out he was about the gloomiest man in the world. He thought that the human race was devouring the fair face of nature, and it was like a sort of proliferation of bacilli, which had got out of hand, you see, the population going staggering, the proliferation of bacilli, which, unless checked, would absolutely devour nature and reduce the world to an impossible desert. The great thing, therefore, was to check this proliferation, you see. He had hopes that there might be a plague. This is before the explosion of the atom bomb. He had hopes there would be a plague, you see, and something would happen. Otherwise, he thought we were completely doomed. And that was that. He was a very gloomy man indeed.
Well, there's something in it, I mean. That's a sidelight on San Francisco I'd never heard before.
Mrs. Galinsky, a very nice man, but he's very gloomy.
But you enjoyed San Francisco?
Oh, yes, it was great fun, yes. Jimmy Dunn, I used to cooperate with him very much.
Yes.
I never took to Alger Hiss very much.
I was going to ask you, you took over from Hiss, but...
No, I never liked him very much. He's an arrogant man, I thought.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Lord
not
Gladwin.
Bit,
I'm delighted that you were able to give this time to us. And if we have a supplementary question or two, we may ask Eric Jensen of the London Information Center to locate you in London and put you in front of a microphone.
Certainly.
Again.
Thank
you.
I was going to get ready for this monster party. 200 people at dinner.
Is this the one of the Secretary General?
Yes.
Oh, yes. You've got a beautiful setting down.